Welcome to 60 Scales and the Truth, a podcast where amazing guitar players reflect on their lives and on how they got where they are today. My name is Niels Guns. I'm a journalist, podcast maker, and a guitar fanatic. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is a player with a very free musical spirit. Yet he uses an application he created himself, the Modal Explorer, to help him compose. A Dutch newspaper once called him the future of jazz. Well, I have the future of jazz here and now today, behind the microphone.
Man.
Welcome to this episode, Reinier Baas.
Thank you for having me.
We're doing this in English, which is a bit of a mindfuck because we're both Dutch.
That's okay. Yeah, we use English at a home when we want our son not to understand what we say.
Yeah, you can only use that the upcoming months, I suppose. Afterwards, he understands it all.
True.
Reinier, you once called the relationship with your guitar a love-hate relationship.
Oh, yeah.
What is it nowadays? More hate or love?
It's more love.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I guess I've improved.
How come?
I think it's because the guitar has a bit of a different role in my output nowadays. So for the music I make, I think generally the focus has been more on the writing and composing and listening and analysis and so other aspects of the music in addition to playing the guitar. Mm-hmm. And the second reason, I think, is that a lot of the technical things like overview of all the scales on the neck and arpeggios and all that, I've kind of gone through that in past years. So I don't have to do as much practice in a technical sense, which I think makes playing the guitar ultimately more enjoyable nowadays.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you've reached that point. Composing become more of a intellectual endeavor then, maybe?
I would say it's both, or ideally it's both the heart and the mind.
Yeah.
Sometimes it may seem like there's more of a system to it. You mentioned this app, the Modal Explorer, which was developed, by the way, by Seth Gorey. Mm-hmm. And he used some of my theory on scales and modes. But that app, for instance, has made the writing process more playful and I would say more intuitive, however you may define that word.
I am not sure about how technically skilled the listener will be, but can you explain for average, I guess a lot of listeners will be guitar players, but explain this app to me, please.
Yeah, so I've been working on this little chord skill or modal theory for about 10 years, and I've dubbed it the chromatic major modes. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's an attempt to answer the question, why do people alter the leading tones on a dominant chord and not on a tonic chord?
Why is that?
Why? So it turns out there's a lot of good reasons for it, but I've continued looking into it, and I've arrived at this little formula. Mm-hmm. So there's a major seventh arpeggio.
Yeah.
So 1-3-5-7.
Yes.
And that never changes. But there are options for the 2, the 4, and the 6. So flat 2, 2, or sharp 2, 4, or sharp 4, and flat 6, 6, or sharp 6. Mm-hmm. And if you permutate those, you get 18 different colors for a major 7th scale. Mm-hmm. So I've been using those a lot and looking into the 7 degrees of each scale. But it gets pretty complicated. And this app that Seth made for me is a way to bypass some of the tedious hours sitting at the piano and trying to figure out the degrees of these modes. So it's been a huge time saver and made the process more playful.
But it seems like quite a mathematical approach also to composing, right? Can you explain a bit?
Well, first of all, I mean, hopefully this is just one aspect of composition, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty technical one if you talk about it, but it's also just a way of providing a menu of colors to choose mm-hmm. from. So it's sort of like a palette for a painter. There's still a lot of mystery and messiness going on in the process. So the composition that itself is not necessarily very systematic or technical, I would say, but it can be a part of it. And I'm not shy of using analysis and the mind in the process as well, in addition to hopefully the heart and intuition and mystery.
But is you playing on the guitar more the heart then? Because I can imagine if you just have your guitar and you just freely play, maybe those difficult aspects you just mentioned, maybe they don't come out of your fingers, right? But maybe they do if you sit down and make an analysis of what you're doing. Is that correct? Yeah. Or?
Yeah, I would say so. I think the benefit of analyzing both your playing and your writing is that you start to become aware of your habits and also, for example, I analyze my own compositions often at the hand of these seven musical parameters. So melody, harmony, dynamics, texture, form, rhythm, and tempo. And I compare my own pieces one parameter at a time. And those are the moments where it's a pretty painful process, you know, because you might figure out like, fuck, everything I write is in G major, you know? Or I always use the same interval at the beginning of a phrase. Things like those. So it's not necessarily super technical, mathematical analysis or anything like this, but the process is about becoming aware of your own habits and subconscious decisions.
Yeah, it's supposedly very healthy to go away from your habits, right?
I mean, I think so.
Brushing your teeth with your left hand, if you're right handed, it seems to be very healthy.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. Yeah, I'll give it a shot.
So, but is that also what you're doing? Like, okay, this is what happens if we talk in English. We should have done that in Dutch. But if you analyze it and you say, oh, it's always G major, that allows you to step back and say, hey, maybe I should try another thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's a reason to challenge. It's a way of challenging yourself to pursue the opposite of your habits. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So maybe a few steps back to the young Renier who started playing guitar.
Yeah.
Was that search, so to say, there from the beginning? Because this seems like you are aware of, okay, I haven't reached limits yet, so I want to grow. Did you have that feeling from the get-go while playing guitar?
The short answer, I think, is no. But what I remember very well is pretty soon after my father brought home an electric guitar, I started learning chords and stuff from this little book I had. And it was my first experience of a flow state, you know, of being completely immersed in something to the point where you forget about time and forget about the fact you have to eat and go to the bathroom and just completely immersed in the process. And I think looking back at it now, I mean, hindsight is 2020, right? But this is something I've been pursuing ever since, I think. So
going back to that initial flow.
Yeah, this sort of feeling of being completely present. And it's a good feeling to have. I think for me, music is one of the few things where I can really get to that point.
I find it super interesting, by the way, that you're using that app nowadays. And I'm kind of intrigued by, where does the flow come when you're using that app? You say it makes the process of composing more enjoyable. Does it pull you towards the flow, or does it also push you away from it?
No, I think it gets me closer to a point where things are playful and almost like childlike. Because with this app, you only press 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 on your keyboard, and it does all these things that normally, again, would take me hours to figure out at the piano.
But that can also bring a flow. I can remember when I first looked up all the inversions or figured it out myself of a G major 7 chord, for instance. You know, it took a while, but I got into a flow while doing that, right?
Yeah, agreed. And those things are not necessarily mutually exclusive, and I still do both. But yeah, for the process, for this latest record I put out,
Which is Relief Party.
Relief Party.
Yes.
So I use this application to make the process more playful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's what you call dance music for odd people, right?
yeah.
Who dances to it?
Me. Yeah, that's about it, I think.
And all the other odd people.
All the other odd people out there.
Around you, yeah. So, more enjoyable, looking for that flow. Because if I listen to your music, like I mentioned in the beginning, to me, you have a very free spirit, right? I'm constantly surprised about what you're playing and what happens next, which is a thrill for a listener, you know? Can you tell me a little bit about that latest album in which you used that app you made?
Like, yeah, for sure. I mean, we've been talking about this app now for a while, but this is just one ingredient, I would say. Mm. But I had certain restrictions in place when I was writing this. I got a commission from the BIM House during COVID to come up with a new set of music. Mm-hmm. And this record is the result of that. And I put in place certain restrictions. So a time restriction, first of all. So I allowed myself 4 hours a day to work on it, to write. And I wanted to produce more or less one minute of music a day. And I had about like 40, 50 days to do it. So there was a time restriction. Also, everything had to be in 4/4.
Wait, pause.
Yeah.
How did that help you, those restrictions?
Oh, I mean, this is a very common theme among a lot of artists, but restrictions can be extremely helpful in the sense that they narrow down the options for you, first of all. So if carte blanche is one of the worst things that can happen to you as an artist, yeah. Like you can do whatever you want. But you need to, or at least I need help in limiting the options. So starting with all the possibilities, all the options that are available to you, mm-hmm. it's actually really, really, really difficult.
That is also maybe because your head seems to be very rich with ideas, right? I mean, if you have so many ideas or your musical brain is quite developed, then I can imagine like here's carte blanche, thanks. Like, oh, you'll drown maybe, you know?
Yeah. Well, it can feel like that. But then at the same time, this seems to be pretty common throughout the arts. Mm-hmm. A lot of great artists in history have used restrictions extensively.
Can you name one example that?
Yeah, there's many great examples. I think one of my favorite ones is Dr. Seuss, the children's author, uh-huh. author of children's books. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called Green Eggs and Ham. And I might be wrong, but I think it's one of, if not the best-selling book for children in history. Mm-hmm. And that was the consequence of a bet he had with his publisher. And he was only allowed to use 50 different words, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the result was extremely creative and imaginative. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of those kinds of examples. Shostakovich, for example, he had a bet with a conductor for 100 rubles, and he challenged Shostakovich to listen to T for Two, the song, once on vinyl, and then he had to orchestrate it from memory in 1 hour at the age of 22. And then he famously did it in like 35 minutes or something. And Stravinsky used a lot of like musical restrictions. David Byrne, the frontman of the Talking Heads, he put it really eloquently. I think his argument is something along the lines of there are already a lot of restrictions in place. For example, the instrument you play and the fact that we generally use 12 notes to an octave, but also the venues where you perform, for example. Like if you write music for the BIM House, that's in itself already like a positive example of a sort of restriction. Because you think about the music that's been played there in the past and the audience that frequents that place and things like that. But yeah, restrictions in general, super helpful.
But I can imagine those restrictions only work if you can only use 50 words. You need about a million words to search from and master those million words for to choose the 50 right words, right?
Fair enough.
You agree or what's your thought on that? I mean, if you only know 50 words, then maybe as well, because that, okay, sorry.
Good question, yeah.
Because this is kind of has to do with the title of this series. This series is called 60 Skills and the Truth, which is a wink to three chords and the truth. It's a popular saying it's been in many chords. I have three chords and the truth.
Yeah.
It can be.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you know 60 skills, you might know it as well, right? I mean, your craftsmanship is different maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So this touches this, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, great point. I mean, it can be both. Music can be really complex and very simple, right? And still be meaningful.
Yes.
I think one pet peeve that I have is when music is complex for the sake of being complex, you know, and that usually I think a listener picks up on this, and that can be really annoying to listen to, you know? But there's plenty of like really complex music out there that I love to listen to, like John Coltrane or Radiohead or Bach, or but also like really, really simple music.
Punk maybe as well.
Punk, yeah. Mm. Hell yeah. There's this famous record of The Shags.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know about it. It's these three sisters that were sort of made to make a record and learn instruments. And there's a sort of naivety to the music and a lack of technique. But the result is still like really singular and impossible to replicate. And also, I would say, meaningful. But yeah, there was C6 Steve, who was kind of in the picture a few years back, who played on guitars that had one string and stuff like that.
Mm.
You know? It's a pretty severe restrictions.
I'm where did I put the pause? I said pause here, and I don't know what I asked before. Do you remember?
Yeah, I was talking about the process.
Oh yeah,
writing this record, Relief Party.
Yes. Okay. So there were restrictions.
Yeah. You said? Yeah. So one of them was everything had to be in 4/4 time signature. And another one was for the keys of the pieces, I could only use the white keys of a piano for the key signatures. So yeah, sort of arbitrarily put in place, but also an attempt to make the music in a way danceable. I mean, again, I wonder who actually dances though. Yeah.
It's funny, I didn't realize that it was only 4/4, because it's also the drumming on the album is so, I don't know, a lot happens.
Yeah.
And it's Jonas, right?
Jonas Burgwinkel.
Yeah, he's a great drummer.
Yeah, and some of the tracks feature Lewis Cole as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He's also a very great musician,
they're both,
right?
Yeah, among my top five, I would say for sure.
Yeah? Yeah. Oh, that's great if you have two of the top five playing on your own.
Yeah, I'm a very lucky man.
So, and you told them these are the restrictions. Were they involved in the composing process as well or not?
No, this was a pretty dictatorial process. Yeah.
You smile while saying the word dictatorial.
Here are the parts. Good luck. No, they have a lot of liberty in interpreting the music, and there's quite some space left in the parts intentionally, because the people featured on the record are all great improvisers. Mm. But I would say it's more composed than most of my previous records in some ways.
Can you tell me something about that process of? Part of it is letting go, right? You say there's a space for them.
Yeah.
Which I can imagine it's your baby. Can be scary as well. Well, if they're that good, you probably have confidence that will go okay. But tell me about that process.
I mean, it's more that last thing. Mm. So again, I feel very, very lucky to be able to play with these people. And sorry, my phone rang.
Yeah, it wasn't a fart. It was a fart.
Yeah, right. So there's a huge amount of trust to go around, and you can literally write something like an improvised piano outro 2 minutes, and and then Kit Downs, the piano player, he'll do something, and it would be something different each time you perform it. I think the added value of improvisation in that sense is the music is different every time, which is really exciting. Things can go wrong. We spoke about Julian Lage before pressing record. He's also an example of someone, I think, who takes a lot of risk in his music and allows for things to potentially fail, but that allows for something meaningful to happen and something to happen that only exists then at that moment and in that place and with that audience. So I think that's part of what makes jazz music so special and exciting.
Only then it's the only way allowing those risks that you can really be present, I suppose, as well, right? Because you cannot really be present if you say no room for mistakes here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe that's not true. I don't know how that works in classical music. Maybe there seems to be less space for mistakes there, but they can be very present as well. So sometimes my mind
it's a really interesting point, I think. I would say generally speaking in classical music, more parameters are defined. So more is written down. Music notation is a limited means. You can't represent music completely in written form, right? Thank God.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of room for interpretation. And also in classical music, you can, I think, definitely hear someone play the same piece with a completely different intention behind it and in two nights in a row, right? So it's really, really That's interesting.
True. Yeah.
It's a mystery.
You just mentioned Julian Lage, who was my previous guest. A returning theme in this series is a question from one guitar player to the other.
Yeah.
Julian Lage knew of your music and he liked it. He said, but I don't know if I have a question for him. So Frank Zappa, he asked, does humor belong in music?
Oh, wow.
We'll solve it this way.
Wow.
Another great guitar player.
Yeah.
And I guess you listen to him as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, right. You hear it in your music as well, right?
Yeah, I grew up listening to Zappa, actually. Yeah? My dad is a huge fan. Yeah, what a great question. What a nice bomb to drop. I would say that for me personally, I like my music to have sort of a grin, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I think it's really hard to define this. It's like explaining a joke, right?
Yeah.
But what music and humor, I think, have in common that way is some sort of unexpectedness and unexpected twists and turns and not always delivering on expectations the way you can see them coming. So there's something there, but maybe by defining it, you also ruin some of the magic.
I
don't know.
You're close to defining it, but I guess what you touch here is that what I love about your music, what I said before, there's a lot of unexpected things happening. Right, and I'm constantly surprised, and I think, okay, this gives, don't define it more maybe, but this gives some sort of answer in that process for me. I mean, seeing music and composing as a joke.
Yeah.
Or some parameters of a joke, at least.
Yeah, yeah. And like the classical tradition, they would have a scherzo, you know, kind of like a funny section or... Almost like comic relief, you know, in these big symphonies. But again, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You know, it can also be really annoying and embarrassing if music is like, ha-ha or something, you know.
And what doesn't work if a comedian, at least that you feel he finds himself funny, right?
Yeah.
That's killing.
True, yeah. Yeah.
So you have to stay away from that as well. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You're not going to say, now I'm going to say something very funny.
Exactly. and I hope that it's not like an inside joke or something like that. You know, this sort of highbrow shit, you know? Yeah, so it's a tricky thing. You're playing with fire, I think, with humor in music. But grinning, at least... I think I allow myself to aim for.
I had to grin at the last song of your album, Negative Nancy.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what happens here? I'm thinking. So tell me, it's like, about that song.
I have a background choir on that one,
which
is the members of Benjamin Herman's band Bug House, which is sort of a punk jazz project, which I'm proud to be a part of. So they did some beautiful singing for that track. When we were in the studio for Benjamin's own project, and it features my wife and son, and it's the whole thing is sort of a feature for Joris Roelofs on bass clarinet.
But who is Negative Nancy?
Yeah, I don't know. No, there's no actual person.
Just sounds okay.
This is really nerdy, man, but there's a negative harmony function on that app we talked about.
Yeah.
So that's why it's called that, but I shouldn't explain this stuff. Yeah.
Okay, I was just wondering because I had in my mind maybe this is something he hates or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Not at all. It's way more nerdy and
Okay, about nerdiness and about your music, I heard you say in an interview as well, the whole, you made a magazine as well that came along with this app and the album, and it was about somewhat, you said, about marketing the unmarketable, right?
That's what it felt like, yeah.
I'd like to talk with you about the theme of marketing. Because you
came to the right place.
Well, you make the product, but what does selling the project, what role does that play for you as an artist? And what energy does it give you, or what energy does it take, maybe?
Yeah. Again, great question. Yeah, it took me a while to come to terms with the fact that if you make a record, especially when it's self-released and you don't have a label, you're automatically sort of in sales, you know, mm-hmm. which is something that, generally speaking, doesn't fit with musicians at all. Mm-hmm. And also for me personally, that's been a pretty challenging aspect of making records, mm-hmm. which is actually trying to sell them to people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, over the years, I think I found my footing a little bit and found a way of handling things like social media and newsletters and things like that in a way that feels authentic. Mm-hmm. And I know way less about marketing than I should. So it's pretty much a black box mm-hmm. for me, apart from certain things I've learned about, like making magazines, for instance. So I think one rule of thumb I have is if I make a physical product, I would like for it to be something that I would also, buy myself. Mm-hmm. So one example of this was a project I did with a great comic artist called T-Pex. Mm-hmm. And he made a comic book along with a record of mine and this kind of tin can with postcards. And like it's a whole thing, looks like a cigar box. But that made it fun for me to try and market it. To try to sell.
Well, it seems more like also a part of art than just marketing by itself, right?
Yeah, that's the thing, you know. I think the process of selling records for me personally is only worthwhile if it's something I'm proud of selling, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And not just for the sake of being able to make another record or... Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's niche music, you know, so for me and most of my peers, this process is about breaking even mm-hmm. And not necessarily about making mm-hmm. a salary from a record, mm-hmm. especially nowadays. Yeah.
But it's interesting how you keep balance in your career, so to say, with that, you know, with, because you teach as well, mm-hmm. right? At the conservatory, we're here right now.
Yeah.
You play live, you make albums, so what helps you maintaining that balance between, okay, I have to make a living, but I have my arts that have to go out there.
Yeah.
What helps you in that perspective?
Well, you mentioned the teaching. I mean, I'm really lucky in the sense that I love to teach. So to me, it doesn't feel like a concession or something that I have to do in order to get by. And also financially, that gives me a lot of freedom to say no to certain things that I don't feel comfortable mm-hmm. performing or to focus on my own music a bit more. So there's some
this Julian Lodge talked about this, Neely Brosh as well, about saying no. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me something about your learning process in saying no?
Yeah, that was a steep learning curve for
me. Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me.
I think by nature, in my character, I have a pretty hard time saying no. So it's a skill that I've had to acquire over the years. It's something that's necessary, I think, or you'll just wear yourself out and spread yourself too thin. Mm-hmm. And if you have too much on your plate, you can't give things the attention they deserve. Mm-hmm. It's something I've had to learn, but I find that if you're honest and upfront, usually people understand the reasoning behind it very well. Mm-hmm. And that goes both ways. If I ask someone and they're like, sorry, I have too much on my plate right now, or I'm into something else, or mm-hmm. Or even like I don't feel the music, you know. That's an honest, straightforward answer.
Yeah. But it takes guts to do that. But also
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah. But you only respect the person more if you get that answer, right?
I think so.
Then you want them even more to play on your album.
Well, yeah.
Hard to get.
yeah, maybe. But I mean, it's a process of trial and error. But at least what I strive for is to be upfront with people. But it can definitely improve. And one thing I have to learn is to call people I've never met.
Mm.
That's like a personal fear of mine.
Really? Because you seem to be very...
Fear. It makes me uncomfortable.
Okay.
Yeah. It costs me something to call someone I've never met.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I thought journalism for a while and some students had that same problem.
Oh, yeah.
And what helped is just doing it.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. After a while.
That's the thing. Yeah.
It becomes less scary.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like there's things like try to do something you're scared of at least one thing every day, you know? That seems to be a good rule of thumb.
Yeah. What did you do today?
Record a podcast. Good question. Yeah, I've had to make an uncomfortable phone call this morning. Mm. Yeah. I messed up. I had to apologize.
But I can imagine that's difficult. Yeah. It's not just calling somebody and you don't know if that's the thing behind it. I can imagine. Yeah. It's scary.
Yeah. But I mean, live and learn. I've become a lot more relaxed about it, I have to say, over the years.
So it's interesting that you, because we talked once before and you seem such a relaxed person. I didn't think of that. Hey, back about
it's
market.
An illusion. It's an illusion.
There's a big wall of guitars. Yeah. And he's behind, the real Renier is behind it. But back about marketing, one very good marketing advice that you gave was people who like the album, please buy it. If you don't like the album, buy it for somebody you don't like.
This is an old joke. The first time I heard it was my friend Mark Lockett, who was a great drummer and a great person from New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some time with when I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got some great onstage banter. Mm. But that phrase, it was too good not to steal.
you lived there or traveled there? Or?
No, I toured there twice.
Okay.
And last time I was there with Ben van Gelder to play duo concerts, and our visa fell through for Australia. So I was stuck between quotation marks in Wellington, New Zealand.
That's always the problem for New Zealand.
Yeah.
Australia didn't go through.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, it was great. I mean, it was a beautiful time.
Mm.
Mark Lockett and his wife, Veronica, they were kind enough to host me.
Mm.
And
give you some marketing advice.
Give me some marketing advice, on stage banter.
You also spent time in New York, which is still, for jazz musicians, a very interesting place.
Yeah.
Right? What did that time give you?
It was a very intense experience. I was there for half a year on a semester of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still kind of wet behind the ears. And I grew up in a very safe environment in Hilversum in the Netherlands. And just to be in a place where the pace is so different and the culture is so different, that's one thing I noticed. It was a culture shock, despite the fact that I spoke the language and I know all the art and movies and literature.
Mm-hmm.
It was still hugely different, especially socially. And also the humor thing we talked about.
Dutch humor doesn't work everywhere, right?
It doesn't work everywhere. Exactly. So that's something I found out the hard way. And I got scammed right when I got there.
Oh, shit.
Through Craigslist. So I lost a significant portion of my savings.
That and seems then, really wet behind the ears.
Yeah, well, can happen to the best of us, apparently.
Somebody in New York once asked me, well, how was your day? And yeah. I answered how my day was, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And she looked at me yeah. with fear in her eyes, like, yeah. how long is this going?
Yeah, great.
That's what we do, we Dutch.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, it was challenging that way, but musically and also interpersonally, it was definitely one of the highlights. I learned a lot, also in terms of being sort of professional at your craft. So things like learning music notation software and learning how to sight read well and showing up on time and having your shit together.
Yeah.
That was a very fast learning, a good school for me.
We were about to say learning curve. You mentioned maybe.
I was going to say learning school. And then I school. Thought that's not a coherent sentence.
Ah, people understand. But because I wanted to ask about that learning curve you mentioned before, a steep learning curve. Most guests on this series are 30-something. You're still 30-something.
Yeah.
Just not about. Not long. What can you tell me about your learning curve on this age? Because this almost 40 in your 30s seems to be for many people quite a reflective age as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I've got some past and I still got a lot of future.
Yeah.
So what can you tell me about your learning curve on this age too?
It's really interesting that the experience you gain seems to almost like balance out the fact that it just takes longer to learn new things, you know? Mm. I got my driver's license pretty late, like 5 years ago or something. And my instructor told me, the average is your age plus 20 lessons. So it's that significant, you know, your brain is just a little bit less neuroplastic.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to say, at the same time, this doesn't really bother me in a way. And as you age, you're just a bit more relaxed about everything, especially having children is a factor. You know, you're not the center of your own universe anymore, which is a huge liberation. But maybe that happens anyway as you age. And there's just a bit more of a healthy separation from the music and the result of your work. And I tend not to identify with it as closely as I used to. I used to go like, if I played a bad show, I would feel like I was a bad person in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Which if you think about that, if you would reverse that idea, it's like if you play a great show, does that make you a good person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would be a ridiculous thing to think, right?
Yeah, but it's interesting how that works, right? Mike Dawes also mentioned that, like, at one point you're Mike, the guitar player.
And
you're Renier. I was about to say Rogia because I mailed you once.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry no for worries. That. But you're Renier, the guitar player, composer.
Before. It will happen again.
But this is sometimes very messy, this one. Anyway. to separate, because you are Renier, the guitar player, but you say, I've learned to separate other Reiniers from Reinier the guitar player.
In a way. Yeah. Yeah. There used to be like a huge weight on music for me because I identified with the result so closely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely improved and it's been a huge, huge relief.
What helped in letting that go or who maybe?
Well, like I said, I mean, having a family is definitely a factor for me.
Mm.
But I can also imagine that it's just a consequence of getting a little older and hopefully wiser.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be a gradual process. But at the same time, it's also something I think I've had to work on consciously. And do some reflecting and ask myself some difficult questions. And I think also I used to have the idea of leaving an oeuvre to the world, you know. That's also changed a little bit. You know, I think I've become a bit more realistic about the impact that I want to have on the history of music, you know. And I think generally we grow up with a very romantic idea about art and artists. And that's a really tall order, really big ask. For instance, like the idea of the genius and like leaving this thing to the world and suffering for it. And so I think I've learned, or I'm starting to learn to relate to the music in a different way, which has been really liberating.
Because when you were quite young, you got like raving reviews, right? The future of jazz, like I just mentioned in my intro.
Told you that.
Yeah, right. Because, but that doesn't help, I suppose, right? Or yeah, well, for your ego, it can be a short term boost. I can imagine. But when you were quite young, the albums you made, like, okay, if you constantly hear how great you are, that must be, that process must be maybe more difficult as well, right? Or
yeah, I think it's related to what we were talking about just now. I forget who told me this, but some great advice I got was also to not identify with good reviews, because that means you have to identify with the bad ones too.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's healthy to have both, probably, but I've certainly had my share of horrible reviews as well, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. The music is not for everybody, maybe. And then again, you know, the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's piece, famously got really bad reviews.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Even The Godfather, you know, got bad reviews. And not that I want to compare my own.
I was just about to say.
with these people, but there's some truth to that idea of you know, not attaching too much value to these things. Although I have to say that people have been, generally speaking, nothing but supportive. And I've learned to really appreciate journalists and their role in the whole thing, and their willingness to support the music in their own way, in their own role. You know, it's not an easy job, I think.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Let's talk about that later. How many minutes do you think we've been talking? Don't look on the meter.
46.
48. Your timing is quite okay.
Yeah.
You say your music is not for everybody, but although I urge everybody who hasn't heard you, give it a listen. Reni Ubas, great player, great composer. Thanks.
Thank
you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, thanks for listening.